The following is a CNA podcast.
Welcome back to The Climate Conversations. I'm Jamie Ho. This week, I'm talking about fossil fuels, and more specifically, those who extract, process, and ultimately provide the energy from which all our economies and lives revolve. I'm talking about big oil, some would call it that, the companies that have powered the globe, but to many who also play significant roles in the past, present and future carbon emissions that have put us on an unsustainable path of temperature increases. Now, what have they done about it? What more must we expect them to do? What have they already done? And how much of it really also is in their best interest to do? With me to talk about these issues and more is Dave Siva Prasad. He's from the Boston Consulting Group, where he's a member of the Global Climate Leadership Team and works with public and private sector clients on climate action and energy transition. Dave, welcome and thanks for being here.
Thanks a lot, Jamie. Thanks for a kind introduction.
Sure. I'm going to start my first question using your expertise, energy transition. What does it actually mean then for big oil companies? How far have they transitioned, say, in the past 10 years? And what are we looking at for them going forward? And probably timelines are going to be shorter than 10 years.
If you indulge me, I would like to start by saying that, you know, energy transition is not a new phenomenon, right? As you know, if you think back of the last 200 years, mm-hmm. we've gone through quite a few of them, mm-hmm. from biomass to coal and now oil to low carbon energies. And I think what's different in this period is just the pace at which technology is picking up and the impact that's having on economies, on energy systems, and ultimately to the large energy players, such as the large oil and gas companies. One of the things that we've seen over the last few years is that momentum has picked up quite dramatically with climate action and subsequent energy transition across various economies. And this has, of course, affected what oil and gas companies will do looking ahead. The primary thing that we feel oil and gas companies need to think about at this stage is really, how do you build resilience in a low carbon world? And where are there places where you can grow and contribute to the energy transition? Mm-hmm. And we start seeing a lot of moves with companies that start to diversify their portfolios in low carbon energy, in renewables, in low carbon transport, and so on. So there are moves at various paces and speeds, let's say.
I think the key thing is the pace. And obviously for those who are looking at real climate events and the realities of climate change, it's never fast enough and moves have not been quick enough to meet those challenges. But on the other hand, you're hearing things like the reality that peak oil has already come and gone. Peak oil in the sense that, you know, sizes of the entire industry for the globe, has it peaked? Some would argue yes, both for the reasons that you need to transition away, but also because the companies are actually doing it themselves. At the same time, there is, however, a lot of still, I would say, some suspicion from the public out there about the path that they're taking based upon what they may have done in the past and still not 100% confident that they're doing what they're doing and they need to do it. How do you understand the depths of the suspicions that the public may have? Is it a matter of companies doing better in saying what they're doing, explaining what they're doing? Or is it, as you say, the pace at their transformation isn't really keeping up?
I would say a couple of things. One is from an oil company standpoint or the oil industry standpoint, there's probably a fair bit of diversity in terms of which companies have taken what response. And perhaps to contextualize also the role of the oil and gas sector in overall emissions, this is really a demand-driven story. So if you think about, you know, where these emissions come from, they come from the power sector, the transport sector, aviation, and so on. So really to effect a rapid transition, the demand side of the question
needs to be
changed,
addressed, yes.
Right? And that can be through consumer behavior, that could be through policy action, that could be through changing the market dynamics by pricing in carbon in different ways. Mm. That's really what will move the needle. Mm. The oil companies are really on the supply side and they play a role.
Yes.
But if you look at the emissions that are contributed, scope one and two you're familiar with, it's within what a company does. Probably 10-15% is in the oil company and 85% is scope three, which is where the product is being consumed. So really to move the needle, you need to address the demand side of the question. Mm.
I would imagine that the companies themselves are doing things from the supply side as well to sort of meet the public demand for action, right? But at the same time, there are changes afoot as well. I was just grabbing my phone, so I was going to read out this Facebook post from Minister Vivian Balakrishnan because I just remembered it. And he says this, I'll quote, "I believe the day will come when we will no longer burn hydrocarbons for energy. Instead, these precious resources will be the raw ingredients for so many essential products of daily life. Even today, the vital layer of meltdown polypropylene of our surgical masks and the isopropyl alcohol used in our hand sanitizers, goodness gracious, depends on the petrochemical industry. The list of personal and industrial products that depend on these polymers is endless. The demand side, on the one hand, seems to be not very well understood. There's so many things in our lives that contribute to the demand, right? Clearly, yes, some moves need to be done to address that. But some will say the supply side needs to change as well. Give me some examples of companies which actually have decided, you know, I think our supply needs to be tweaked a little bit. Let's go into a different area, renewable, alternative energies. You may not be able to speak of specific companies, but just give me some examples of companies which may have already started on this move.
There are companies that have been more progressive around this and are contributing to the solution, right?
Okay.
So if there's demand for power and there's significant investment that these companies put in place in renewables, in storage, in low carbon technologies, then you're contributing from the supply side. You're giving consumers the alternative to switch in terms of energy sources. There are companies that in their downstream operations in refining and petrochemicals, applying both operational methods and investing in these assets to drive greater efficiency, to reduce emissions in operations, drive greater circularity in their in their use of resources, which reduces the carbon intensity of the product in the end, right? And this also leads to better outcomes on the supply side. So there are a whole host of supply side actions that the industry and companies are taking, again, to various levels of ambition and levels of focus. But it's also an opportunity for these companies.
Exactly.
Right? It's an opportunity for growth in a world where demand for fossil fuels declines.
Exactly.
And these companies have great technical capability and talent that can be deployed in expanding the possibilities of where sources of energy can come from. They have a great opportunity for growth. And some of them are taking it.
That's a great point, because if we now talk about the demand side, clearly as well, demand is changing. There will be some that can meet this new demand and some that will be left behind. And as we said earlier, the pace of which demand is changing is actually happening much, much faster than it was maybe 10 years ago. So looking at it from your perspective as a consultant, how would you say your advice to companies, let's say 10 years ago, what would it have looked like then versus what would it look like now? Give us some sense of what it actually sounds like when you speak to these companies.
Tough question, JV, because, you know, it's hard to predict the future. Right? But what I would say is that a number of triggers can really change the environment very quickly. Consumer behavior changing can change the market and the supply side. Policy action by countries. So there are countries and cities and regions that have stated objectives of banning internal combustion vehicles on their roads, right? Depending on how ambitious you are, that changes the supply side picture there as well. Pricing in carbon and other externalities can also change the market.
Yeah.
So what I would advise companies in these discussions is watch the signals and watch them very carefully. And they are very diverse and they vary by region, they vary by market. But watching them carefully and responding, anticipating ahead is really what would keep them resilient.
Yeah, good point. If I were to put myself in their place, some of these big names, and we know who they are, they've put into place investments that are such long-term investments in big countries, in big infrastructure, in big technologies that were meant to last a long time. And for many of them, I would imagine it's not that easy to transition, to switch gears. Are you sympathetic to that? And if I were, let's say, the CEO of Shell or BP or Aramco or whoever else it might be, and I'm serious about this, but at the same time, I know the kind of investments I've put in and how difficult it is to shift the Titanic, to use an analogy. What's the best way to do it? Is it a way of incremental moves that need to be done? Or is it something you need a really big, strong decision to say, this is it, we are moving 100%, turning directions entirely? What's the best way for a big company like that to do things?
Yeah, a tough question, Jamie, because, you know, all these companies have very different contexts, right?
Mm.
So if you're an international oil company, you have shareholders that drive your behavior. If you're a national oil company and you're a custodian of the country's reserves, your mission, so to speak, is to maximize the value of this for the country.
But that's the trick of the question.
Vary, right? It does vary on your context and what purpose you serve. Broadly, it would be one where you need to manage transitions of assets in your portfolio that no longer are worth what they were before. It is inevitable that that will happen. then the question is, how do you compensate for that in different ways?
Mm.
How do you drive greater value through more efficiency in what you already have? Where do you not place bets in areas that actually add to the stock of legacy assets, but rather shift your capital allocation and your strategy to more forward-looking energy investments? Where do you create the potential for shorter cycle returns? So in the industry as a whole, you invest in an asset or a power plant.
Mm.
It's a 25-year investment. Where are there places where you can shorten that? And there certainly are places in low carbon energy and in low carbon mobility and so on. It'll be a tough one for any of these companies to manage. But thinking about all these options and thinking about how you manage transition is a key priority for all of them.
I want to start talking a little bit about governments as well and use one of the points that you raised about reading the signals. That's going to be a good point and a good advice that you're going to give them, because governments give out sometimes clear signals, sometimes less clear signals. When you look at it and we see what happened in the US election in the campaign period just before the elections, how things like energy, climate change, transitions, transformations can become so politically fraught. Right, there are very differing views in societies and governments about this. One of the reasons, obviously, is job losses. And if you're a company and you're trying to read the signals, it can be hard. And what's the kind of advice that you give them? That sometimes, is it always just about reading the signals? Or is it also about balancing that with what the signal that you want yourself to give as a company?
I think there's a place for leadership as well.
Yeah.
Right. There's a place to say that if you're a participant in the energy system, and you understand it very well, it is almost a responsibility to show leadership and engage and educate the broader constituents in society, in the political system, on what the pathways are, what the choices are.
Mm-hmm.
So certainly they should play a role.
Yep.
I think one of the things, as a side note, I think one of the things that these elections have also shown is the power of civil society and the power of voters, right?
Mm-hmm.
The fact that if millions of people believe that this is in the interest of the country, the society, the broader planet at large, and you take action, it may move at glacial pace at times, but when it does, it creates a whole set of, let's say, movement and momentum that can really move the needle, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I think the US is a good example that you just described.
Again, talk about governments then. You have some work advising them too. All of them are different in terms of how far fossil fuel-based industries feature in their overall economy. How do you advise them as well? Because things are moving so quickly, given the varying structures. And if you are one country now, a government which knows that the change is coming and you are quite dependent upon this, what are the steps that you need to take? And some may be taken independently, I would imagine, of the industries themselves, because as you say, sometimes leadership is needed. But at the same time, you need them on board with you too. Give us a sense of the kind of advice and the conundrums that you sort of present to governments.
Similar to the discussion we had on companies, the context of countries are very different, both in terms of where they sit in their own development, their own economies, the role they play in climate and energy transition. All these matters, right? So context matters a lot. It's also helpful to reflect that when we think about the emission footprint globally, 10 countries contribute about 70%.
Mm-hmm.
It really matters what these 10 countries do. That aside, more in general terms, if you're any country with economic and socioeconomic objectives to achieve, and in the context of recovering from this pandemic and economic crisis, there is a dual opportunity to stimulate growth and progress a green agenda.
Yeah.
That are not divergent in nature, right?
Exactly.
And there are quite a number of these investments and policy actions that can drive both. So, for example, driving adoption in renewables has shown in multiple contexts that expanding your renewable capacity also generates jobs and at lower costs, up to a certain point, right? I mean, there are limits today with the technology and so on, but these are almost, you could describe as no regrets for countries to take, right? Within the confines of what is possible. Then there becomes a question of where in some areas, depending again, which country, where you are in the economy and so on, you may selectively take leadership in some parts of the new energy system, you know, whether that's on low carbon transport or whether that's on energy efficiency, investing there, putting policy measures in place to encourage the development of these sectors. Energy efficiency is a fantastic example because most countries have a technology and digital agenda and they're highly complementary.
Mm-hmm.
right? In terms of how you manage demand, how you manage energy demand, how you manage the usage of energy across industry, commercial, residential use, and so on. So these are all dual benefits that all countries can take. The harder choices do land with the bigger emitters, right? Because, I mean, they will need to take leadership to really move the needle.
I'll now try to be a little bit more specific and talk about Singapore, where we are now. I'm glad you raised energy efficiency because I think there are many areas within energy efficiency where Singapore is taking quite a clear leadership role. We've done quite a few things that are internationally recognized as well and internationally relevant. What else do you think lies out there for Singapore to leverage off too? Because there are so many things as far as technology is concerned, whether it's carbon capture, whether it's alternative energy. As you say, there are options out there as a country like Singapore obviously also starts transitioning away from fossil fuel-based petrochemicals. At some point, there is another pot at the end of the rainbow, right? In your work, do you think there are really quite exciting options out there for Singapore to look into?
I think Singapore has been very progressive in adopting technology and in pushing the agenda. Now, Singapore is also very small, right? So it doesn't move the needle in the broader climate and energy transition space. Now, that said, given the unique position Singapore has in Southeast Asia, it can play a very active role in facilitating collaboration across across the countries in the region, taking selective leadership in certain areas such as driving how externalities and carbon may be priced in the long term.
Yep.
These are all areas that Singapore has a unique opportunity to play in the area of financing climate green transition. Again, Singapore has a fantastic position and can play on that advantage. For Singapore to push the needle a bit further, it is the role it could play even beyond the borders.
Exactly. The most recent news we saw in Singapore was when Shell announced a couple of layoffs, quite significant. But obviously, they painted it as part of their overall transition away from crude-based industries. And obviously, when people on the outside look at it, the job losses always are one part of the equation. But I suppose governments, and when you advise them, want to look at how you reskill people, how you transition the entire economy to create the new jobs. Surely there must be a nice narrative as well. And we see this, it's become so politically fraught in the US. You know, I mean, it's always about job losses. Are there areas for optimism that, hey, we are well placed to ride this new sort of green wave, green technology, green finance? These will provide the jobs, you think?
If I speak about Singapore, I think Singapore has been very good at driving this reskilling agenda. We've seen that in technology, in digital, and so on. Now, it's not dissimilar with what the new green economy would look like if you fast forward 10 years, 15 years, and so on. The challenge, I feel, is to start early because these transitions take time, right? And we're talking about a generational transition. So so starting early in the cycle of building new skills and capabilities that the workforce of the future will need, you need to start in the education system across. The challenge is for folks in the workforce today that face that challenge, you know, looking ahead in the next 5 years. And here, again, huge public sector and government leadership is needed to drive these transitions. And there are no easy answers.
Yes. Right, I mean, the question I ask is, when all these things come up, in whether it's in the UK or the US or anywhere else, and leaders try to seed the notion that we need to move away from coal, we need to move away from other pollutive industries, they need to say, hey, you know, there are jobs out there. The new green economy, the clean economy is going to provide the jobs. I just want, and I hope, more of that comes out as well over time. As I go into my last question then, and again, it's quite related to this, is to bring it a little bit more contemporary and talk about COVID-19 and recovering from that. You hear terms being used like the green recovery. It's now been, oh my goodness, nearly 10, 11, soon to be 12 months after the fact. And you see countries recovering to differing degrees. How far do you think we've made use of this crisis to make it a green recovery, or at least learn some lessons that, hey, there are many things that in the years to come, we can still ride on to make this actually a green recovery that lasts for a little while longer, that, you know, is different from a past recovery, from a past recession, that this one is different. This one has a good, strong climate / green agenda behind it. How do you think we've done as the world as a whole? I presume we can do better, but are there bright spots, and where else can we look to?
I would say, Jamie, that still certainly a lot more to be done. So if you actually look at the level of committed investments, certainly Europe is leading in terms of investments allocated to green. And the amount that's needed to really fuel a green transition will be multiples of what has been committed to today, right? So most estimates say it's within, you know, 1-3% of global GDP that's needed, and it's fairly similar across countries, right? So that's the volume we're talking about. Now, that said, what is certainly very encouraging is in the start of the crisis, early this year, much of the debate was around whether climate and energy transition will take a backseat.
Yes.
It was one of, you know, let's control the pandemic.
And then we get back to that,
get back to economies restarting and so on. And if you fast forward to now, 10, 11 months on, huge discussions and debates and also commitments that countries have made, companies have made on a climate transition. You've seen the announcement from China, from Korea, from Japan in our part of the world. We've seen companies make these announcements in Asia as well. So very positive momentum, right? So a lot more to be done. The quantum is huge, and the orchestration around this is also very complex and massive in scale. But the signs are promising. And it's to keep this pace on transition and accelerate it that will be what we all need.
Well, as the saying goes, you never let a good crisis go to waste. Dave Sivaprasad, thank you so much for speaking to me.
Thank you very much, Jamie.
And thanks for listening to The Climate Conversations. This podcast is part of CNA's broader coverage of climate change. You'll find all our content on cna.asia. You can also find this and other CNA podcasts on our website, app, and on iTunes and Spotify. The team behind this podcast are Crispina Robert, Lin Su Ling, and Erin Low. This podcast has been recorded on Sennheiser. I'm Jamie Ho. Till next week.